Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Garden Cult, garden design and coaching. For a 15% discount on virtual garden consultations and coaching sessions, use code HRN15. Learn more at gardencult.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're celebrating the food culture of South Carolina with its chef ambassadors.
Oh, I'm super excited that it's soft shell crab season. Those little suckers are delicious.
People think, oh, tomato is a tomato. No, there is a good tomato and a bad tomato. So when they come to Hampton or even, you know, even in South Carolina, you can really find incredible ingredient.
We started getting lettuce from Micro Leon Farms in Conway. It's a super sweet family that runs that little farm.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, April 27th, 2021, and we're recording remotely. We'll be talking about the Craft Brewers Whiskey Project with three very interesting guests. So let's go around the room and introduce ourselves. First, Chris.
Sure, this is Chris Weld, founder of Berkshire Mountain Distillers in beautiful Sheffield, Massachusetts.
All right, Jack.
Hi, I'm Jack Endler. I'm one of the co-founders of Jack's Abbey Craft Lagers and Springdale Beer in Framingham, Massachusetts.
Great. And Rich?
Hey, I'm Rich Eyring, senior brewer at Harpoon Brewery.
Okay, so an intro. This is a very cool project. A few months ago, Angela reached out to me about the Craft Brewers Whiskey Project. And no one really knows this, but I'm a huge fan of distilled beers. And going back to the folks from the United Importers, I've had many of the Schlenkele and Uriga, the German distilled beers, as well as some from Japan, the Hitachino distilled beer. So I think it's cool. So we're going to talk a little more about it. And let's start with Chris. So Chris, you're at Berkshire Mountain Distillers. I've had your Berkshire bourbon and your New England corn whiskey. I'm a big fan of what you do. Let's jump into where this project came from and why distill beer. I think your quote was, it's beer turned whiskeys.
So, you know, for us, we're a small brewer, a small distillery, which allows us to be pretty nimble. And, you know, there are a bunch of commercial distilleries that have made over a century's time, maybe one or two whiskeys. And for me, I love craft beer. I love beer in general. And I think that each beer presents an opportunity to make a unique whiskey from it. And I like to collaborate with these folks. It's a great group of brewers that we got going here on this project. And I've had some experience distilling beer before, but nothing at this scale. Roughly, I don't know, must be about 6 years ago, decided to sort of tackle this and get a big group of brewers together, pick some select beers from those brewers, one from each brewer, and distill it into a whiskey. And it's a lot of fun, but also it allows us to put out 12 new whiskeys that are all wildly different in a year's time, which is a pretty unique thing to be able to do.
So it's quite a commitment, isn't it? I mean, you started this in 2016 and now it's 2021 and you're just releasing them.
It's a huge commitment. It's a time sink. It's a financial commitment. My analogy is sort of like owning a restaurant where you have to pay your staff and buy the goods and make the meals and put it away for 5 years before you get to sell it. But which is hard for us small distillers that are fairly young. But it's amazing. It's a really wonderful journey to be able to try these whiskeys throughout the years and watch them change. And for me, we sort of hit a sweet spot in our whiskeys, just our climate and how we distill our whiskeys at about 3 years of age. And this project, we were planning to release it last year when they were turning 4 years. However, COVID hit and, you know, the wheels kind of fell off the industry, and we regrouped and just decided to launch it this year. And they're just, they're all pretty superb and really happy with the way they turned out.
That's great. And more, for more intro, I mean, you're distilling regularly. What do you distill from usually, and how is that process different from distilling from beer?
Sure. So, and people tend to get confused on this, but typically we distill on the whole grain. So we will, you know, grind the grains, we'll cook them, and then we don't lauter them. So they go into the fermenter, sort of a soupy porridge, and the yeast is added, and we ferment on the grain. And then that whole wash is pumped, or distiller's beer is pumped into a still, and we distill that versus, you know, much scotch is made that it's lautered and it's a thin sugary liquid that's, you know, fermented from the grains. And then that's distilled as a thin beer, basically. So typically we distill a soupy porridge. And on this project here, it was essentially a ready to drink beer that we distilled.
That's great. So let's go to Jack. So Jack, Jack's Abbey Lager, I remember in 2016, you guys rolled out in New York City, and we interviewed your brother, Sam. Tell us about your backstory. Like, where did you study? Because there's some relation between the beers that you make and distilling beer traditions as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Before Jack's Abbey was opened, I brewed for 6 years in the Boston area. I also went to brewing school and trained to brew in Germany. And one of the things that's fairly common, particularly for many smaller breweries, is to also distill. Some distill beer that they've presumably, I don't know if it's planned or not, but there's certainly plenty of beer schnapps, or some of the really interesting are like dry hopped distilled products. But there's certainly plenty of like fruited brandies and stuff that smaller farms that have that growing on their properties anyway are looking to distill. It's sort of a good relationship between a brewery and a distillery if you can do both.
Yeah, that's great, man. I mean, in lagers, well, how did you get? I mean, everyone knows the story, but I've never heard it from you. Why did you focus on lagers at Jack's Abbey?
Lagers, well, for me, lagers are my favorite styles of beer to drink. And as the head owner and co-owner and brewer, it made a lot of sense to basically brew what I wanted to drink. So, you know, that's sort of how that all happened. But, you know, it's funny looking back 10 years now and thinking when we opened in 2011 that we really thought the IPA market was saturated, and we had some serious concerns about where the industry was going as far as styles, and we really wanted to stand out. We certainly were wrong on one aspect, that the IPA thing certainly has not quit in the last 10 years. But on the flip side, we certainly are right that we differentiate what we're doing at our brewery by continuing to focus on brewing lagers.
Great. Let's go to Rich. Rich, tell us your background and what you're doing at Harpoon Brewing.
So my background, so I got into the beer industry, right about 2011 as well. In the beginning of the year, I, interned for a little over a year at a brewery that no longer exists on the South Shore of Boston, Blue Hills Brewery. So I interned there for about a year and a half while I was still working full time and, at a desk job, and realized that was, you know, really what I wanted to pursue. And I had a pretty big passion for it. And, a couple openings at Harpoon, came around, and I applied there, got the job, started there in spring of 2012. And I've been there, you know, just a little over 9 years now. I started in the cellar, cleaning tanks, dry hopping beers, making sure fermentations were going great, running the filtration room, the centrifuge, and then about 3 years into my stint at Harpoon, I got promoted up to the brew house, and I've been there for the last 6 years. So my day-to-day is, you know, just running the brew house. I have a couple other duties on top of being a brewer with ordering ingredients, making sure all of our miscellaneous stuff is up to date, and some recipe building and recipe archiving.
Well, I think I just, the most recent Harpoon I had was your winter warmer this winter.
Oh yeah.
Which was really great.
It's a fan favorite. We don't make a ton of it, but it all goes out there and gets sold out and drank.
Yeah. So the process of picking these beers. So Chris, back to you with this project. I know you had, how many different breweries did you make whiskey from?
There are 12 in this project, all from the Northeast.
And then when you were with Harpoon and Jack's Abbey, what was your process of selecting their beers? Because they both have so many good beers. I mean, what are you looking for when you're distilling beer? Were you looking for certain flavors? Does color come through when you distill?
So the distillate is always crystal clear for us. The process in choosing the beers was sort of multifactorial. Yeah, there's a component of brand recognition. So part of this is a wonderful collaboration between the brewer and the distiller. And it's nice to feature a flagship beer if that beer makes sense. So for us, there are other components like the ABV of the beer. So if you're having to move a whole lot of beer that's only 3% alcohol, you know, you have to move three times as much beer to the distillery as if you had a higher ABV beer. And then one of the things that we found throughout the years with distilling beer is that the hops can tend to come over and add a bittering component to the beer. So we're just careful on the IBUs on the beer that we choose. And then we also wanted a variety in the project. I mean, one of the really great things about this project is that each whiskey carries over or has the genetic code of the beer from whence it came. So you can taste the UFO white and the orange peel is like blatant in that. People keep asking us, are you putting orange in this? And it's funny because the Smoking Dagger, I made the mistake. At least I tasted it first. That one just got bottled this week. And it is, the nose is sort of more traditional whiskey nose on it. But the palate, which I don't pick up so much in the nose, is pure chocolate and coffee. It's just crazy. So, these things come over into the whiskey and you know, now we're going to be releasing this year 12 whiskeys that are all very unique.
Yeah. So, Chris, why did you pick the black lager from Jack's Abbey instead of any of their other great lagers?
Yeah. So I think, again, we wanted to have sort of a smorgasbord of beers that we were distilling. And we Jack, do you recall, I think it was 4 beers that we picked to test distill. And we went through them and a couple of the lighter ones and then ended up, we did test distillations in a small still. And this one just had really nice aromas that came over on it. And that's how we picked this one. We did that with all the breweries. We picked a few different beers to distill, sort of a range of beers from them, and then picked one that we felt would age.
I remember 3. I believe you that it's 4. I'm not sure what the 4th one, but I believe it was Smoking Dagger, Red Tape, and House Lager were at least 3 of the 4 that we tried. But again, it's already like 6 years later. It's tough to remember the ones that we didn't pick.
Well, I'll believe you it was 3 because I had 12 of these guys with a bunch each. So, I'm a huge fan of the House Lager, and it's just the distillate of the Smoking Dagger kind of spoke to us, but it was great. I mean, that's part of the process. We did it with all the brewers and we picked out beers and brought them home and to the distillery and distilled them. And then, went back to the breweries and tasted them with the group there and picked ones that seemed to make the best whiskeys and also that had some brand recognition in it.
Wow. And what size batches were you making for these test runs?
Oh, the test runs went on a little 10-gallon copper still that actually translates pretty well, amazingly, into the bigger batches that were done on a 800-gallon still.
Wow. Hey, let's talk more about you, Chris. When did you make your first still?
So 15 years ago, but in eighth grade, I was, there's a book series on homesteading called the Foxfire series. And there's a chapter on making moonshine stills. And in eighth grade, I convinced my mother to allow me to make a moonshine still for my eighth grade science project, thinking I would be the coolest kid in eighth grade. And then she found out it was a federal offense and put the kibosh on the project. So it was sort of smoldering within me. And then 15 years ago, I bought a still in Kentucky that was dismantled, and it was a old Brown Foreman test still that had never really been used much, and trucked it up and designed and built a column system with some folks at Vendome in Kentucky. So about 15 years ago, we've been distilling.
Yeah. And you were talking about different kind of beers that are distilled. I remember having conversation with some Scots many years ago, and they were talking about, they said that they blamed the success of the Scotch industry for their bad beer. Now, I'm not saying their beer is bad, but I guess they were saying that they turned out so much beer to make into whiskey that that's what their priority was. Does that make sense, or is that true?
I don't know if that's true, but I suppose if you know, all of the good beer was being usurped to make whiskey, I could see that happening. And it's, you know, basically that's all we're distilling is beer, distiller's beer. So it's the same process. The difference, you know, for Scotch, especially the smoked and peated stuff, is sort of the substitute in the beer is the hops. But you drink a Scotch that's really smoky and peaty and tastes like iodine, and that comes over in the distillate and carries through the whole aging process, much like the hops does on a beer that we distill.
Yeah. Now, going back like 6 years ago, what were conversations that you, if you can remember, Jack, they distilled at least three of your beers. What were some of that process or conversations, or was it you can't remember?
Well, I specifically was very interested in the Smoke and Dagger because I am not a huge fan of Scotch, but I am a huge fan of Rauch beer. And I was curious what the smokiness from a beer like Smoke and Dagger would, and how that would end up in the final whiskey. Now, I haven't tried it, so I'm not sure if any of that smokiness actually carried over or not. But that was, for me, was sort of like, why don't we try to make a smoky whiskey that I would want to drink as opposed to a peaty sort of flavor. So I'm definitely curious and interested to see if any of that characteristic came through.
It did, and I think you'll be safe with this one. So, yeah, it's really a really crazy whiskey. And I think the neat thing about the distillation process is when you ferment, whether it's something for a wine or a beer or a spirit, the yeast goes to town and eats the sugars, and it creates ethanol, but all these other alcohols that in the distilling world we call congeners. So you have amyl alcohol and butyl alcohol, and you've got aldehydes and fusel oils and all these things that are produced sort of according to the yeast strain and the raw material and the fermentation temperature. And when you're drinking a wine or a beer, all those compounds are in that wine or beer, but all those compounds have their own volatilities. So through the distillation process, we're able to separate out many of those compounds and make, you know, what we call cuts and get rid of some of the heads, the first part, and the tails, the last part, to come over. And we can sort of tailor the whiskey according to the taste profile that we like. And also, you know, any of those errors that are not errors, but any of those compounds in a beer, there's a compounding or a magnification of those in a whiskey that may be really palatable in the beer. But if you left too much of the heads on in the whiskey, it may give you a bad taste.
Yeah. So why do you focus on low IBU beers? What does too many hops do when you distill them?
I think it's like drinking a head crusher IPA. It's just a bit overwhelming. So there's a bitterness to it, and it just sort of hangs on the palate too long. And we grow hops on my farm here, and we've done a lot of distillation with pure hops. And even, you know, 8 years into the barrel, we have some of them that are 8 years old, and they're just much too hoppy, and they really just hang too much on your palate.
So you're not going to make an American Fernet with hops or something?
I want to do the American version of a green chartreuse with botanicals from the Berkshires, but not just hops, I think.
So that's a nice one. And then, Rich, so you guys at Harpoon, the process of how did UFO get picked to be the beer for this project and other anecdotes about it, because it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I to be honest, I was not really part of the process in choosing which beer that we were going to send over to Chris. I know we had tested a few different ones. I think IPA might have been one of them, but that was too hoppy, too many IBUs in there. And I believe that they had ended up coming out with the UFO White because of the coriander and the fruit aspect of it, to see if that was going to come through with the final product. That beer is also very low in IBUs already. And I remember for the brew day, we actually cut out all the hops in that specific brew, so there was essentially no IBUs in it. We ended up blending it with another batch later to make up for it for, you know, on, or no, they, we sent most of that over to him. So maybe we didn't blend it, but that's as far as I know is why we chose UFO White. Chris might be able to dive a little deeper into that part.
Yeah, no, I think that's about it. It was a great day. We actually drove, I took my crew and we drove out and started at Mass Bay and went up into the bar and tasted through the beers. And then after, you know, 12 hours up there, went to Jack's Abbey and did the same thing there. And we just went through a set, and the, you're right, the UFO had that beautiful orange to it. And we, I mean, to me, it's much akin to distilling a gin, except for that the orange is in the beer already versus adding the botanicals, you know, including orange peel to a base distillate. But essentially, the orange from the UFO carries over into the whiskey, just like an orange peel and a gin would carry over into the gin.
Yeah.
So that's why we chose that one.
And then, Chris, just some basics like logistics and licensing. Are you able to get beer from any brewery in any state and then distill it and sell it? Just walk us through how that works, because it seems like you have mostly Massachusetts breweries.
Where do you use license? I think I've heard that word before.
License.
So there's actually a small fee tax, I believe it is, that you have to register for beers that are coming from out of state. The beers in state are very easy for us to transport and purchase. And the ones out of state, it's a really nominal piece of paperwork that you have to fill out. So it's really more the logistics of, you know, moving that volume of beer back and forth. So that, I mean, we did, oh Lord, I would say 5,000 gallons of each of these probably. So it's a lot of weight to move, and you know, it's an exciting day when this stuff comes in and it's cold and frosty and looks palatable. One of the things that I did figure out early on was to, we actually stopped that when we could, having the beers carbonated, so they come to us without the carbonation in it and a little bit lower temp. Just try and bleed that out. The more times it's run through a pump and stuff, it blows off that CO2, which the CO2 in the distillation process adds a lot of time to it, makes it difficult.
Wow, that's totally fascinating. Jack, do you have any questions for Chris about the process?
Specific to our beer, we've certainly talked about it when we did it a few years ago. So I don't think I have any specific questions about the distillation process. It was fun getting the trucks coming to the brewery, because a huge tanker would come up and we have to figure out how to run a hose all the way to the outside of the building and get it filled up. So that was quite the quite the brewers. The brewers were a little surprised when I was like, okay, we're going to have to run a 200 feet of hose and get out to this tanker truck so that this beer can get out for distillation.
That's pretty cool. And you must be proud, right? I mean, you studied in Germany and you're inspired by that beer culture. I don't know. Have you had any of the ones that I mentioned, like Schlenkler or Uriga, some of these fine distilled beer spirits?
I've certainly had the beers. I've had, I have not had the Schlenkler. I didn't know Schlenkler was doing distillation, but the Uriga, I have had that one. But I, when I'm in Germany, usually trying to make sure I try every beer that I have when I'm over there. I generally, just so I can stay awake, avoid too much of the distilled stuff.
Yeah. And what about service? Who wants to talk about that? I always thought, I think years ago at my old pub, Jimmy's Number 43, if I could have chosen and not just sold what people wanted, I thought, well, I'm just going to have a beer and a shot, or a beer and a small glass of whiskeys. I'm not going to do any cocktails. Is anybody serving like that, their beer with the same distilled spirit next to it, Chris?
So we have a bevy of restaurants on board for that. The whole COVID thing threw a wrench in the works. And the, I mean, the wonderful thing about drinking one of these beers with a glass of the whiskey next to it is that, you know, you can really tell that the genetics have passed through to the whiskey. So it's a really great sort of science experiment on it. And we do have a bunch of events sort of on hold, just waiting for the on-premise or the restaurant world to open back up after the pandemic here. But yeah, it should be fun.
Yeah, I saw a packaging you had. It was of the Spencer Trappist Ale with the Spencer Trappist Ale American Whiskey side by side. I don't know if that was just a post, but I would definitely want to taste them together.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about this project is we had the brewers give artistic input to the labels. So if you look at the Craft Brewers Whiskey Project website, it's just a great, I mean, it's worthy of a poster, some really great labels there. And so the brewers kind of had some sense of ownership in the project too. And hopefully it seems like things are loosening up in the COVID front, on the COVID front, and hopefully we'll be able to get out into the on-premise world and do some tastings and events side by side.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to take a short break. Before we do that, we have a new thing. I'm reading a weekly beer haiku. There's a haiku writer, Matt Kerr. He's at Awkward Haiku. And this is the beer haiku of the week. This beer I'm drinking, it's dark malt, smell of walnuts, a fine nut brown ale. Thanks, Matt. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Garden Cult, garden design and coaching. Carmen DeVito is a professional garden designer, certified New York State landscape professional, and the founder of Garden Cult. You may also know her from HRN's home gardening videos and our series, We Dig Plants. Garden Cult is a culmination of Carmen's more than two decades of experience designing and building gardens in New York City. Carmen believes that gardens and outdoor spaces should be healthy, environmentally sustainable places that enhance the health of people, nature, and the planet. She knows how to help you maximize the space you've got, help you work with and make the most of the materials, plants, and trees that you already have, and create an outdoor place to use and enjoy for you and your family. Get started at gardencult.com. For a 15% discount on virtual garden consultations and coaching sessions, use code HRN15 through September 30th, 2021. That's code HRN15 at gardencult.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Check us out and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. Well, we're doing a special show about the Craft Brewers Whiskey Project with Chris and Jack and Rich. So, Chris, you said that whiskey is beer's older cousin. Why is that?
You know, the whiskey has there's an heiress, a bullet bourbon heiress who has a line something to the effect of bourbon's the only thing Americans have to wait for. So, you know, once you distill a beer and to make a whiskey from it, it really needs years in the barrel. It needs to benefit from the aging process. And so it takes a bit of time and a bit of age.
I actually have a question if I could ask it. I'm curious if, because beers, you know, you talked about how you normally distilling this product that has all this grain in it. I would tend to think from a brewer's perspective that the flavor of that fermentation is, there's a lot going on where the beer that you're getting from brewers, you're probably getting a fairly clean fermentation. Does that change how much time that needs to be to age it?
Good question, Jack.
I'm not sure it changes how much time it needs to age it as much as, you know, I think for the whiskeys, the lore is that, you know, at least the Kentucky lore is that distilling on the whole grain adds a little bit more character to it. And granted, a lot of the stuff that we distill is a corn-based component to it. Whereas with the beers, you guys are using, you know, different malts and stuff that add a flavor of their own to it. So I don't think it really changes the aging process, or not that I've noticed, I should say.
That's good. Rich, you have a question for Chris about this project?
Yeah, I don't think we covered this, but how did you decide on the 12 breweries that you ended up going with for all the releases?
Okay, so UFO White, Spencer, and then Big Elm 413 were the first three that came out. Sam Adams, who I've done some stuff with before, Jack's Abbey, Berkshire Brewing, Smutty Nose, Oma Gang, Captain Lawrence, Long Trail, Chatham, and Two Roads. And for one reason or another, I seem to have a strong relationship with those brewers, whether I drink a lot of their beers or I know them and drink a bunch of their beers. But again, it was a Northeast-based pick of brewers that I respected and loved the beers of. And you know, there's certainly, I spent some time on the West Coast. I would have loved to have thrown in a few West Coast beers just to round it out, but it's tough to truck beer from the West Coast. But so, you know, basically all these brewers, we had an interest in for one reason or another, and obviously think they're doing a great job in the beer world.
Wow. That's great. So Chris, do you have the whiskeys in front of you right now?
Of course I do.
So tell us what you note. What's noteworthy of them? So you have both the Jack's Abbey and the Harpoon, right?
Correct. So I think, as I mentioned briefly before, the Harpoon, again, is, you know, these are very clean, controlled fermentations. We're much more down and dirty. I mean, we're a week, sometimes less. Our rum fermentations, maybe a few days. We let our temperatures get up into the high 80s. So it's a very different world than the beer. But for the UFO, as I said, it's sort of akin to a gin in that the botanicals in the beer distill over and are caught in the distillate and make it through the aging process. So that orange is really prominent even after 5 years in a barrel and all the things that a barrel does to a whiskey. So it's got a smooth, like mildly sweet, malt component to it. But for me, it's the thing that I find on that is it's really the orange on it that sticks out to me. Just a very drinkable whiskey. As I mentioned, the Smoke and Dagger one has sort of more of a classic whiskey nose to it, not as aromatic and orangey as the UFO, no orange to it, but more of a whiskey knows when he knows it, but just an overwhelming sense of chocolate and coffee and when you drink it.
And then does the smoke come through at all in the whiskey?
You know, it's there. It's not like a peated scotch, but it's a smoked peated scotch, but it's definitely there and adds a complexity and a roundness to it, which is neat. So again, you know, these are 12 uniquely different whiskeys. Yeah, a lot of coffee and chocolate on that one.
So how can we get these whiskeys?
Well, so the 413 just made it to the distillery, being a smaller brewery and just trying to keep up themselves. We didn't get a lot of their beer to distill. The Spencer and the UFO has made it across the state. Not sure how much of it's still around. And then this release here, the next one will be a Sam Adams Boston Lager whiskey, the Smoke and Dagger, and then one from Berkshire Brewing. And those will go out. But they're actually getting released in the distillery this weekend. So we'll keep them at the distillery for the first month. It allows us to sort of educate people that come in about the project. And then they'll end up across the state June 1. They'll be available.
Wow.
And Jack, I'll bring you some before then.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it.
I know. It's pretty wonderful.
Yeah. So, Jack, just tell us, let's catch up about Jack's Abbey. I know you've got like a lemongrass beer out right now. You get so much out of lagers. What's coming out now?
Well, we're always trying to push the boundary of lager beer. You mentioned Raycatcher, which is our summer seasonal. That's a rice lager that we brewed with lemongrass. So it's not overly herbal. It's just sort of a nice, light, lemony character to that beer. But usually we're releasing one or two new beers every single month. We've done a few new hoppy lagers, including I think tomorrow we're packaging Nelson Brow, which is a Nelson hopped lager that we do. And we also have a Zwickel. We've never actually brewed the Zwickel before, first time, and that'll be coming out in the next week or two as well. So excited to do sort of pushing both like the American side with the Nelson hops, and then as well as the really traditional side with finding some like really unique and underbrewed traditional styles that really are hard to find these days.
Yeah. What's the Co-Pilot series?
Co-Pilot is sort of a catch-all for all of our R&D and experimental beers that we do. And generally, those products are only sold at the beer hall. We've sort of been in and out of how we do them. They used to only be draft beers. Obviously, that hasn't worked the last year plus. So they went to all canned beer. The beer hall is going to be opening up again in about 2 weeks. So we are looking to be able to do sort of a more of a mix of draft and cans, but again, just for the beer hall. And that could be a beers that are experimental. They may be proof of concept. They may be, it may just be that the beer hall specifically needs a specific style of beer because even though it may not be a product that we want to distribute, there's a need for the beer hall, and that's sort of where like Blood Orange came about, where having a very light, refreshing beer for that was in contrast to some of our stronger beers sort of evolved in that pilot R&D setting.
Well, that's great. And then just what has inspired you in recent years, like a German or Czech style or even a brewery over there?
I'm really interested in a lot of when you talk about Germany and Czech Republic and some of the continental lagers, I'm really interested in trying to bring back some of the processes and some of the more traditional brewing practices that have sort of not really evolved in the US to the same degree, where for ale brewing, America is certainly cutting edge, well ahead of the rest of the world. But I feel like in many ways that we're just beginning this revolution in lager and really trying to push that forward and start bringing some new ideas, both from the raw material side, but also from the actual process side.
Wow. And what are some of those processes?
Well, you know, a few of them are decoction, brewing, natural carbonation. There's a lot of sort of unique, when you start thinking about really small farmhouse or small town breweries that are still using like open fermentation or are using very old equipment that's still heavily using copper or honestly, a lot of them just have iron in them. I wouldn't recommend that. But and then, you know, things like float tanks and things like utilizing some malts that maybe not are quite as modified that can really work well with some of these other traditional brewing processes.
I'll tell you, I remember whenever it was 2016 when Jack's Abbey came to New York City, suddenly all the beer guys and beer writers that I knew, I'd see them, they'd be walking around with cans of Jack's Abbey Lager. So you guys have been doing a great job, man.
Very nice. Glad to hear that.
Thanks. And then Rich, just tell us about some new things coming out at Harpoon. Also, the first question is, there's one brewer that I've interviewed who said he made the first Harpoon IPA many years ago. Do you know who that is?
I think it was Russ. I forget his last name. He was one of the original brewers, and I believe he came up with the Harpoon IPA recipe. I can't believe I'm blanking on his name. I've met him a couple times. Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, I don't.
Were you testing me or?
No, I'm literally blanking. I just remember maybe it's been three or four different guys that have said, oh yeah, he worked on the old Harpoon, the original IPA or something.
Right. Yeah. Trying to think I know it came out as a summer seasonal one year. And then it flew off the shelves. So it basically became our flagship almost within a year of starting to make that. But as for stuff we're putting out now, we're getting hot and heavy on our summer seasonals. They're going to be hitting the shelves fairly soon. So like our Camp Juana Mango is what it's called. It's our mango pale ale for the summer. You can get it at Fenway when Fenway opens back up. We did a release second year in a row of our house marg beer. So it's kind of a play on a margarita, which is pretty cool. So it's got a mixed fermentation of our house yeast and a little bit of lactobacillus to give it a little bit of that sour tartness. And then we added some oak spirals, lime puree, some agave syrup and sea salt in there, which was pretty cool. Everybody is pretty excited about that. I think it's the second year we've made that. And our UFOs are just coming out, and our grapefruit shandy is back out this year. So we just made a batch of that. So that's coming soon.
Wow, man, this is pretty cool, Chris. You brought together some very cool people.
Yeah, it was, as I said, it was herding chickens in the beginning, but certainly well worth it. there's 12 there. Just going to talk one little science bit on the distillation process. So there were six beers from Massachusetts, the UFO, the Sam Adams, Spencer, the Jack's Abbey, the 413, and the Berkshire Brewing. And they all got triple distilled in a pot still. So pot stills don't fractionate as well as a column still, and you're left with a fairly significant volume of heads and tails that you've made cuts on. But when you add up the heads and tails from these six breweries, the beers from them, it was a significant volume for us. So we redistilled those a couple times and had a center cut of probably three or four barrels worth that was really pretty nice. So it's an amalgamation of the six beers. And I don't know if everyone remembers this, but everyone signed off on us doing this. And the plan is that after we've released all 12, we'll end up with, you know, a couple thousand bottles of this whiskey that will probably be about 6 years old from the six of these together. And we'll do a bunch of charitable events with that. So it's kind of a cool end to the project.
Wow. And then you said that when you're looking right now, you have a couple of the whiskeys in front of you. How's the color, and can you predict what the color will be five, 6 years ago?
Yeah, I thought I could. But there is some variation in the different whiskeys, and I don't really have an answer for that because they all went into the same types of barrels, and it could just be that you get these distillers select barrels that they go through and they taste 1,000 barrels in a rickhouse, and a couple of them taste different or better or age differently. And I don't know if it was something inherent in the barrels that adds a little bit of color variation. They're all in for almost identical amounts of times, but some of them are a little bit darker than others. We try not to release anything prematurely, and these are all very respectably colored whiskeys in front of me here.
And back to Jack, just a Jack Savvy question. When and why did you start putting hops in lagers? And I just want to hear, that story. That's a good one.
That's from the beginning. We knew we weren't going to be brewing ales, but we did know that there was certainly a lot of interest in hops at that time when we opened. And I think the biggest surprise was Kiwi Rising. We did that a few months into operations, and that was a double IPL at 8.5% using all New Zealand hops, particularly Nelson. And that of course was this weird time where you couldn't get any hops, but for some reason Nelson you could buy. So the hop broker was like, here, try this one. We can't sell it. No one will take it. We're like, sure, why not? And then we had a huge success with that brand, and then we called to order more, and they're like, yeah, people figured out that they like this hop, so there aren't any more. We're like, great. But, from the beginning, one of the things that I really like about brewing hoppy lagers is it's sort of a different perspective on the hop, where in an IPA, there's those competing flavors with yeast, there's competing flavors often with the malt. With a golden lager base, you sort of let the hops really shine. So I think it's sort of a unique way to get some great varietal specific hop aromas, but still have it light and palatable in the finish.
Wow! And then what about for your colored lagers? You made the Smoke and Dagger, the black lager. I don't know, inspirations for that, for different, are you making a Czech lager that has color, for example?
So, yeah, the problem with the dark lagers, and we brew a lot of them, is they're very challenging to sell. So I keep brewing them. So we do a Czech dark lager. That's part of our co-pilot series. It hasn't actually made it out of the brewery yet. Smoke and Dagger for... I feel lucky that we can brew Smoke and Dagger now 10 years in, and it's still a beer that we brew year round. Framing Hammers are a Baltic Porter series, and we do that seasonally. But I just think that there's this huge window of styles that are sort of missed in the lager conversation. A lot of breweries will say we brew a lager, and you basically know that they're talking about a Pilsner or maybe it's a Helles. But there's sort of this misconception that lager is just golden, and that's just not the case. There's so many different styles. There's so many different great traditional beers out there. And I think it's important to, even if we can't necessarily make a huge business out of selling those styles, to keep on brewing them and be able to have that conversation about what lager is and why it's important that there's all these different styles and characteristics that you can brew.
I'll tell you, I'm going to make it to Framingham one day and try all your co-pilots and your fun stuff. Cause I'm going to just keep following you, man. Thanks so much, Jack.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then Rich, you guys again, Harpoon IPA. What other beers are at baseball stadiums for you guys? That's a whole nother show, but
I know at Fenway, I'm pretty sure you can get IPA, UFO White, and then the Camp Wanamango, the Mango Pale Ale. And I think they all come in 16-ounce cans too. So that's pretty cool. But those are the main three beers that you're going to find at any of the ballparks or, you know, down at Gillette and whatnot. Because those are our, you know, main beers for summertime drinking.
For you guys, with the range of beers that you have, do you have different systems? Like, for example, for the UFO versus IPAs, do you concerned about the hops and the systems or whatever?
Well, not really. They all come through the same brewing vessels, I guess you could say, in our brew house. They all, you know, go from start to finish, from the mash tun to the louder tun, kettle, whirlpool. They all go through the same system. You know, it's really just the change of ingredients from beer to beer. And, you know, we can pump, if we're running 24 hours, we can pump through about 6.5 to 7 beers in a 24 hour period. Lately with COVID, with, you know, everybody's sales being down and whatnot, we're usually only around 4 a day. So, you know, we're brewing IPA one day, we're brewing UFO White. And then we also have, you know, our seasonals come through. Excuse me. And then we also have the Clown Shoes brand is under the Mass Bay Brewing umbrella. So we're brewing 3 to 4 Clown Shoes beers a week as well.
Oh, that's great. I remember when they first started, we've tried them. Mm-hmm. And then Chris, wow, man, what a great project you have. And what are you, a farmer, chemist, and construction guy, right?
pretty good amalgamation of those three. Sure.
Yeah. This is pretty cool. You guys are all Massachusetts, and it's a real great little snapshot into your world. You know, so much of what we've done has been in New York, and really appreciate you guys coming on. I guess we're just going to sign off, all right? So big thank you. And so, Chris, we can check it out at the Craft Brewers Whiskey Project. Thank you, Chris, from Berkshire Mountain Distillers. Thanks, Jack, from Jack Abbey's in Massachusetts, and Rich Eyring of Harpoon for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our engineer, Armin Spingen, and producing intern, Caroline Fox. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.